The Tom Woods Show, episode 581.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I haven't done an episode on my own in quite a while, so today I am doing exactly that. I'm going to go through an article that was brought to my attention. We're going to go through it and respond and overturn misconceptions and have a lot of fun. I'll tell you about that article in just a minute. I do want to point out very quickly that my poor friend Yaro Starak, whose webinar I've been telling you about, was going to be held today, had to be postponed because the poor guy has food poisoning. So if you're interested in that webinar where he's going to explain how he uses his blog as an income source, so in other words, he wants to earn something other than personal satisfaction from blogging, then you'll want to check it out on Monday instead, Monday, February 1st. You can sign up at tomwoods.com/blog webinar, all one word. Today I want to look at an article that, of course, is linked on the show notes page. Gosh, you must get so tired of hearing me say that, but I want resources available to people. So it's going to be there, tomwoods.com/581. And it's called The Religious Problem with Libertarianism, and it's by a guy named Bruce Ashford, who is apparently a professor at Southwest Baptist Theological Seminary. And apparently he's been doing a series on different schools of political thought, and now in the fourth out of the seven, he's arrived at libertarianism. And I don't think it's a particularly good article, and it doesn't show that he's done a whole lot of reading in it. He doesn't, for instance, seem to be aware that there is a libertarianism that goes beyond limited government libertarianism, or that isn't just Robert Nozick. But I'll take that. That's better than a lot of people know, that's for sure. And he didn't mention Ayn Rand even once, so I give him points for that, because Salon cannot write an article without ever mentioning Ayn Rand, although they can't write an article, by the same token, that does mention Murray Rothbard or some of the other key architects of libertarianism intellectually. Anyway, forget about that. Let's get talking here. Basically, this is the standard kind of criticism that I have seen of libertarianism in, let's say, conservative Christian-type circles. There are no surprises here. So I think it might as well just be answered. So what we find out, first of all, is that libertarianism places, quote, extreme emphasis on liberty. All right, that's one way to put it, I suppose. But I think it's better to think about libertarianism as being an aversion, involving an aversion to the initiation of violence. We are opposed to the initiation of violence. I think it needs to be put that way in this context, because then it's much more difficult for people like Bruce Ashford to glide over it the way he does. Because he'll say, well, you know, liberty isn't everything, and some things are more important, and we, you know, so on and so forth. But if he instead had to justify the use of violence, then I think it would be much harder for him to use glib platitudes. Then I think he'd really, really have to justify himself. It's easy. Anybody can say, well, you know, there are other values other than liberty. Yeah, okay. All right. I've heard that a million times. I get it. But I'd like to hear them address our primary argument, which is that you shouldn't use violence against peaceful people. And I would like his argument to be seven reasons we need to use violence against peaceful people, because then at least it would be honest. Then at least it would be frank, and he'd be confronting the issues at stake. But we don't get that. He says that libertarianism, in a way, is like socialism. All right, I'm game. Go ahead and tell me, in what way is libertarianism akin to socialism? Well, he says socialism takes a perfectly good principle, equality, which I do not consider to be a good principle, but he does. We'll take the principle of equality, and it will stretch it so that it covers all of society, and it'll stretch it out of its proper role. He says, well, likewise, libertarianism does the same thing for liberty. It takes what is basically a good thing, but then it exaggerates its importance. You know what I mean? So in other words, yeah, sure, it's good to have some liberty, but we also need to crack some skulls too. He doesn't quite put it that way, but I wish he would. I'd like to hear that. I'd like to hear it stated that way. There's a lot of flowery language in these anti-libertarian articles, a lot of flowery language about the need for community and working together and no man's an island and all that. Instead, I want to hear about the billy club, the hangman. I want to hear the reality of what it is that you're laying out, not the pretty picture, not the cute little phrases. I want to know the enforcement mechanism. All right, let's move on. Let's see. I got paper. I'm not looking at this on the screen. I got my own paper. So if you hear ruffling of paper, that's me actually. See, it's genuine. I'm reading this article here. All right. Ideological libertarianism seeks to free us from nearly every conceivable restriction. What it's trying to free you from is violence. It's trying to free you from violence. And then you can believe what you want to believe. You can live the life you want to live. But we're not going to commit violence against you. That's all. That is all the libertarian is saying. The libertarian is not saying you can't live by a moral code, is not saying anything like that. It's just saying, don't use violence against peaceful people. Now, listen to this paragraph. I don't see any specifics in this paragraph, and that's a big problem. In the place of this sort of autonomous freedom, we as Christians should seek a different type of liberty. True freedom, according to Scripture, does not entail removing every possible restriction, but removing those restrictions that violate our nature as beings made in God's image. Okay, so I guess we'll get a bunch of examples of that. For example, we're getting one. It is perfectly good for Americans to achieve a legislative and judicial consensus that taking the life of unborn babies is wrong, a position that cannot be justified, according to some libertarians. Some libertarians. Well, what about the libertarians who think abortion violates libertarianism? Well, they don't get mentioned in this article, because that would complicate the picture, because don't you know that libertarianism is kind of like socialism, and it's bad and whatever? So we can't deal with pro-life libertarians, so we just won't talk about them. Well, is that how they're scoring debate points at Southwest Baptist Theological Seminary? He says, our personal freedoms conflict more often than we realize, and the government must arbitrate those conflicts to prevent anarchy. That's the paragraph. So we did get one specific, but in the one specific he gives, he implicitly concedes that some libertarians already agree with him. All right, so give me examples of our freedoms coming into conflict that don't actually involve property or assault or the sorts of things that libertarians are talking about, aggression. And maybe he'll say, well, you're making noise and that disturbs me in my house and I have a freedom to enjoy my house and you have a freedom to make noise. Okay, but libertarians have already handled that. If you've read anything about this, we've already talked about things like that. So, for instance, as Rothbard talks about it, well, first of all, there are a bunch of ways you could deal with this. First of all, maybe the best way to lay out neighborhoods is in neighborhood associations, so that there are certain bylaws that you agree to when you move there, and so that when you move there, you have certain expectations that the other people will agree to those rules, and everybody agrees to them voluntarily. Everybody agrees to them voluntarily, which is the way humane people should really try to interact with each other, I think. And so that would be one way of dealing with the noise thing. The bylaws say after 11 o'clock, shut the music off, put your headphones on, whatever, think about other people. Okay, fine. See, he thinks libertarians think only about themselves. It's the salon caricature that we just sit around thinking, well, I'm going to play my music because I'm the only person in the world. We really don't think that way, and you wouldn't have many friends if you did. And libertarians do like having friends, just like other people. We like having friends. But another way to deal with this would be through the easement concept. You can see how the easement is used to allow for access through some property that something has gone on for a long time. Then it becomes an easement right of access through a particular area. So if somebody then later comes to own that area, the easement right would still exist. Well, likewise, suppose you have, this is the classic case, suppose you have an airport. And then I build a house, 10 feet from the border of the airport. I cannot justly complain, hey, keep down that racket out there with your stinking airplanes. I'm trying to get some sleep. The airplane was there first and thereby homesteaded an easement right to the emission of the noise. However, if I've got my house here and then suddenly an airport comes right next to me and starts making a lot of noise, they haven't homesteaded that easement right. And so either they'd have to cease and desist or we'd have to come to some kind of arrangement. They'd have to buy me off, in effect. They'd have to reach some kind of satisfactory arrangement with me whereby I would consent to the emission of that noise. So this can already be dealt with without violence. That's why I wish I could get some examples of what are examples of our personal freedoms conflicting and the government must arbitrate those conflicts. Well, individuals can come into conflict with each other, that's right, but that's not really our freedoms coming into conflict because I don't have the freedom to punch you in the face unprovoked. I don't have the freedom to take your stuff and run away with it. These are not cases of our freedoms coming into conflict. That's a case of a rights violator coming into conflict with somebody else's rights. So again, this is not a case of our personal freedoms conflicting. So I wish we had gotten some specifics, but this is not surprising. We never really do get these specifics. It's always flowery language. It's always generalizations. We never really get the specifics. And I won't dock him too many points for his automatic assumption that the government must arbitrate those conflicts to prevent anarchy. Okay, well, given that conflicts must be arbitrated, why is it automatically assumed that the government must arbitrate them? As we've seen in the United States, we've had a tremendous explosion in private arbitration services. Now, Bruce Ashford must not approve of that because, according to him, the government must arbitrate those conflicts. But it turns out that we can actually arbitrate them ourselves pretty well without the government. And in fact, the government takes forever to resolve conflicts, and it's extremely expensive and time-consuming, which is the opposite of what private dispute resolution companies are able to provide for people. So here we have, in this article, frankly, the seventh grade textbook version of how government works. It's just there. It's an innocent bystander that's just there trying to bring about the public good and to provide goods that we couldn't provide for ourselves. Now, there is nothing in the history of the 20th or 21st centuries that would lend any support to that contention whatsoever. That would justify that level of naivete at this late date. There is no justification for that. And then, of course, it's equally careless just to assume that because a service must be provided, it must be provided by government. Well, that's a leap, and you can't just say that. I mean, that's the very thing that libertarians are questioning. You can't just assert it and claim that that's an argument or not even address the fact that this has been dealt with in many, many books written by libertarians and libertarian legal scholars. Then he says, most libertarians seek to restrict government's role so dramatically that it would prevent the government from achieving other good and legitimate ends. Okay, because that's what we know about government, that it's just trying to carry out good and legitimate things, and somehow it winds up doing, you know, 999 times out of 1,000 things that are not good and not legitimate, but we'll think of it as its nature being something that does good and legitimate things. All right. Again, I'm this naivete seems extremely unjustified. But all right, he's going to say one of these legitimate ends that government has is a modest leveling of the social playing field. Now, I don't know where in the Bible there is justification of a modest leveling of the social playing field, where there's just some arbitrary standard that's not spelled out in this article, by the way. It's just got to be leveled to some degree. We'll leave it up to our public servants to decide exactly to what degree. No possible problems could arise there. Okay, he says, the Christian notion of justice does not exist without a Christian notion of compassion for the poor, which sometimes means extending aid to those who cannot care for themselves. Now, he thinks this is in opposition to libertarianism. I don't know why he thinks this. Any libertarian is perfectly free to say, yeah, I agree that I have a moral obligation to help other people, and I'm going to go do it. So there's, unfortunately, Bruce Ashford has found it so difficult to break free from the reigning orthodoxy, from the conventional wisdom. He can't imagine society performing a function that he associates with the state. So as soon as he says we have to help the poor, it just naturally occurs to him that this must mean the welfare state. Now again, I challenge him. I want a biblical verse that calls for a welfare state. Now, especially given that he teaches at Southwest Baptist Theological Seminary, I'm pretty sure they believe in sola scriptura. And if he's going to tell me that this is not just some idea that he's derived from Christian teaching, but that it is actually spelled out expressly as a tenet of Christian teaching, that there must be the violent expropriation of some people to benefit other people, I'd like to see the verse. I want to know where that is, because that they believe that all this stuff comes from the Bible. So, show it to me. Why couldn't this moral obligation be enforced simply by the conscience? Why do we automatically go to violence as the first resort? We must go to violence for this. Even when we look at international aid, the American public voluntarily donates twice as much as the whole U.S. government does. And of course, they would give even more if the government weren't taking so much of their dough already in the service of the various wonderful, good, and legitimate programs that Bruce Ashford thinks are okay and that only ideologically blind libertarians would oppose. The welfare state has, I mean, doesn't he understand, right? I mean, surely, you're teaching at Southwest Baptist Theological Seminary. You know the effects of the welfare state. What it has done to people, what it has done to people's work ethic. There's no question about this, how it confirms people in destructive behaviors and in self-centered behaviors and in entitlement mentality that other people owe me things. I, in my life, have seen this again and again and again, and Bruce Ashford is not doing any of these people any favors whatsoever with this condescending stuff about how they need to have the violently expropriated fruits of other people's labor. And he says, after all, when it comes to wealth, and here comes the Obama phrase, we are always liable to exaggerate our role in acquiring it. Aha, you didn't build that. And to ignore those who assisted us in getting there. Not a one of us can truly pull himself up by his own bootstraps. All right, okay. I will concede that I couldn't do this podcast without the microphone company. That's true. But I paid for the microphone, so we're even. Or it's true. I couldn't be where I am today without, electricity, right? But I pay for the electricity, so we're even. But think about this. I couldn't be where I am today without the accumulated capital stock of the last 300 years. Now, how am I going to go pay for that? Am I going to dig up dead bodies and give them $5? You know, if I were to try to think of every conceivable thing that's helped me, it would have to be communism. I'd have to just give up everything to everybody. Because, of course, I couldn't have lived the way I live if anonymous people hadn't invested in the stock market years ago or hadn't invested in capital equipment. I wouldn't be where I am today. What am I supposed to do about that? I wouldn't be where I am today without my parents. So what, I mean, is he saying that I should be sending them a check out of my earnings? I mean, of course, I would support my parents if they need me to support them. But, I mean, this is odd. I mean, supposedly it's libertarians who think only of a cash nexus. But really, I mean, am I supposed to send them a check? What is this all about? And, you know, so even if this is true that as a single isolated person, I obviously couldn't have been producing all my own clothing and producing all my own food. Okay, that's true. But again, that's why I work, so I earn the money to be able to pay for those things, and everybody's happy and justice is satisfied. There's no lingering obligation that I have. I've paid for everything, or somebody else has paid for things. If people pay for things for me, I'll reimburse them. And that concludes our obligations toward each other. But how would we know exactly how much I owe? Well, I guess Bruce Ashford is going to say that our wise public servants will just figure out a reasonable amount. Well, whoa. I mean, even if it were the case that I can't take credit for everything I've done and I got all kinds of other benefits, it does not follow. It is a non sequitur to go from that to the government should arbitrarily confiscate property from some people. The one to the other does not follow. By this principle, everybody receiving welfare should have to pay it all back, because you have to repay people you owe, because you didn't get to where you are without the help of a lot of people. So I guess people who are tax recipients, we're going to have to pay all that money back. The wealthiest countries on earth are the most free market countries on earth, and they are also the places in the world where you would most want to be poor. If you had to be poor anywhere, you'd most want to be poor there. Then we read one final criticism of libertarianism, concerns its belief that the free market will somehow always act as a benevolent force. Most libertarians believe that if the government would simply get out of the way, the free market economy would naturally fix society's problems. That's just not true. I certainly do not believe that. I think you will always have some social problems. And some problems can't be fixed by economic means or by private property. There will always be people who engage in self-destructive behavior, for example. The point is, stop subsidizing it through Bruce Ashford's policies. Stop subsidizing that behavior. Stop subsidizing cultural degradation by holding up bad behavior, self-destructive behavior, as some kind of model or as justifying wealth redistribution. Don't do that, and you'll have fewer problems. But you won't have no problems, and you'll never guess. He doesn't quote anybody, because, of course, no libertarian ever said anything as nonsensical as this. And then he says, this is naive, both historically and theologically. Yeah, that's why nobody believes it. So, and then he says, I'm going to skip ahead to a different paragraph. He says, sinful greed and envy, which in practice play a major role in the free market, cannot lead to sinless utopia. Okay, another commonplace that is irrelevant to the discussion. Whoever said there would be a sinless utopia? Whoever used the word utopia to describe what libertarians want? This is preposterous. In order to refute us, they have to attribute ideas we have never supported. They have to attribute to us words we have never said. Then they quote no one, usually make an offhand reference to Ayn Rand, and I give Bruce Ashford credit for not doing that, and then they just leave it. But it's interesting. Well, let me go back to this first paragraph, though, because that was relevant because of the utopia word. I mean, come on. Then he says, historically, all that is needed is a quick glance at those moments in our nation's past when innovation outstripped regulation, such as the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. I guess he means the American version of the Industrial Revolution. When the free market has no checks or balances, the strong tend to prey on the weak. Okay, so why is it that under the free market, again, I've used the statistic over and over again, why is it then that under the free market, under economic liberalism in the classical sense, the average annual daily income has gone from $3 to $33? And under Bruce Ashford's preferred system, where there is a, where the common good He accuses us of naivete, right? The government is going to enforce the common good. Nothing naive about that. His preferred system, where there's a government in charge of everything, where the free market is not allowed, where there is every kind of minute economic regulation in the world to make sure that consumers aren't taken advantage of or whatever, you had stagnation. You had just stagnation. You did not have economic growth really that was worth speaking of. The strong prey on the weak? Then how has population increased to the billions and billions we have today? If the strong preyed on the weak, wouldn't all the weak be dead and we'd have like 100,000 elite people left? How can that be? Look around you and look at the lifestyle the weak enjoy. The weak enjoy a material standard of living and opportunities that people, the greatest kings of Europe couldn't have imagined. The poor enjoy that. Even the poor save up for vacations where they travel distances that would have been unthinkable to virtually everyone who ever lived. The strong prey on the weak? Without the free market, the weak would have died out. But in the free market, the strong have to cater to the weak, because the strong have to produce goods on a mass market at prices that the ordinary person can afford. And as for the Industrial Revolution, Bruce Ashford is acting like all he's read, again, is what he read in middle school. And I always use middle school, by the way, because I remember in 7th and 8th grade, I remember what I read about the Industrial Revolution. And I thought, oh my gosh, why didn't they have wise legislation to prevent blah, blah, blah? Because the society was so dirt poor that your wise legislation would have destroyed the whole Industrial Revolution, and people would have been vastly worse off. No, to the contrary, there was a debate among historians in the 20th century. It was called the Standard of Living Debate, and it was won by the optimists, by the people who say this, that the Industrial Revolution improved the standard of living. Yes, there was child labor, and that's regrettable. But yes, there's always been child labor since the beginning of time. And yes, people worked in miserable conditions. Then why do you think they took those factory jobs? Because every other condition they could have worked in was much worse. See, I mean, why is Bruce Ashford not even bothering to ask that question? If it was so bad, why did people do it? Why did people flock to the factories? Because they enjoyed a standard of living that was better than what they could have had in some dead-end, back-breaking agricultural labor that was not remunerative enough at that time. That's why, by every measure we have, people's standard of living improved. Obviously, by the standards of the year 2016, they were living very miserable lives. Yes, but is that the reasonable comparison? We've had over two centuries of at least a hampered market economy to increase the standard of living. It's not fair to compare that to when the modern market was really just getting going. But the reason people earned so little and the purchasing power of their money was so low was that the society was dirt poor. You know, when output is really low and you have a lot of people who want that output, the price is going to be high. So what you want then is to produce even more output, and the abundance will push prices lower relative to wages, and people's standard of living will rise. That's what the Industrial Revolution was making possible. And thankfully, thank goodness, this was happening without the Bruce Ashfords of the world, who would have been throwing a monkey wrench into this process, holding back economic progress, making people languish in poverty much, much longer than was strictly necessary. All right, finally, again, this whole thing about greed and envy playing a major role in the free market, why don't they play a major role in government, which is supposed to put right all the problems of the free market? No mention of this. There's no mention of the fallen people who might also be serving in government. The free market is where wickedness and envy and evil. Yeah, no, not envy. No, envy is. No, he says envy plays a role in the free market. No, envy is the purview of government. The free market is where people are made better off by mutually beneficial exchange. Envy comes from people who want to circumvent the market, who want to override the market, who want to change the outcomes reached on the market and get other people's stuff and use it and keep it for themselves. That's where you see envy. You don't see that on the free market. You see it among people who lecture us about how wicked the free market is, when the free market isn't even a thing. It's not a thing. It's just a series of exchanges. It's people making deals with each other. And we're told that sin and envy are involved there. Well, welcome to the world, because you'll find that everywhere. You'll find that under communism, socialism, fascism. You'll find it under monarchy and democracy. You'll find it in governments. You'll find it in chess clubs. You'll find it everywhere. The question is, institutionally, where can we cope with it best? And obviously, it's in the market. When you have sinful people in government, well, you get 100 million dead like we had in the 20th century. When you have sinful people in the market, well, there are checks. He says there are no checks and balances to the market. Are you kidding me? Other firms, for one thing. And secondly, there are still laws. Libertarians do believe in laws, and those are checks as well. But I can just simply stop buying something. I can't stop buying the services of the government because I'm not really a paying customer, am I? Then he quotes a moral philosopher as saying, in the marketplace, and I always love this when they turn up their noses at ordinary people who just want to make exchanges and improve their material condition. You know, the average person who wants to educate his kids and live as comfortably as he can after working really hard. I love these philosophers who turn up their noses at these people. In the marketplace, our desires are aroused so insidiously and scratched so efficiently that we spend our lives and fortunes just finding new places where we might itch. he sniffs at the average person. You know, I don't know what to say to that, except that is just arrogant crap. That, oh, we have so many opportunities, it's killing us. We have so many things to choose from. All we do is think about what we can choose. You know, the average person would say, shut your mouth. Like, I work really hard so that I can provide basic sustenance for my family. And yeah, if I have a few innocent pleasures, can you philosophers allow them to me, please, without lecturing me about how stupid and frivolous my life is? Oh, these people who warn us about consumerism, whatever, are the worst. Yeah, some people get caught up in frivolous things. But these are people who are going to get caught up in frivolous things no matter what economic system you have. Thank goodness we have, thank goodness the free market has produced enough wealth that we have the leisure time to sit around and complain about the way we're being corrupted by all the wealth that's being created. You know, I wish people had had that problem 1,000 years ago instead of worrying about whether they were one bad harvest away from starvation. I wish their worst problem was philosophers sitting around wondering about what was going to happen to people faced with all this wealth around them. You know, and I bet those people wished they had that problem too. All right, check out the show notes page for the link to this article. It's tomwoods.com/581. And if you do enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider joining me as a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com. You get more benefits than PBS and any other benefit you can think of put together if you are a supporter of this show. And I used to think the least was membership in my private Facebook group, but people love that private Facebook group, so maybe it's one of the best things I offer. Please consider doing that over at supportinglisteners.com. Tomorrow, it's the debate analysis you've been waiting for. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.